You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee could soon start letting passengers donate the change in their pockets to benefit the area's homeless people. We'll find out the details. First, the U.S. House kicked off debate over the Farm Bill today. The massive bill is responsible for nearly $500 billion in government spending, and changes to it will affect a lot more than just agriculture. Governor Scott Walker endorsed the House bill in a letter yesterday to Speaker Paul Ryan, supporting requirements for work or education for many recipients of food aid, and Wisconsin farm organizations are weighing in this week. Samantha Mosier is an assistant professor of political science at Missouri State University. She's with us now to talk about the bill. Samantha, thanks for joining us. Well, let's get a sense of what the Farm Bill is. I think people hear Farm Bill and think it is only related to farms itself, but it does a lot more beyond things that affect farmers directly. Can you talk about just some of the different things this covers?
So the Farm Bill is actually an omnibus legislative bill. So it's actually a very large bill that actually takes a lot of different pieces of legislation or a lot of different issue areas and rolls it up into a package bill that's presented and voted on. So the Farm Bill itself doesn't just impact farmers. It's just not an agricultural bill. It's also a food bill as well. So the last Farm Bill had a total of 12 different titles in it. And what this means is that there's 12 different areas that the bill focuses on. So it includes everything from crop insurance programs to conservation measures, farm credit and trade, rural development. And then there's this big component that a lot of people get very upset about to some extent, and it's food stamp programs or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which constitutes roughly 70 to 80% of the total spending on the Farm Bill.
And let's start with that. And there's a lot of the debate over the Farm Bill has to do with that SNAP program, as I understand it. What kind of changes might be coming this time around?
For the SNAP bill in particular, there's been a lot of proposals, particularly out of the Trump administration and for Republicans, wanting to cut back the cost of the program. So in 2016, that program ran approximately $70 billion in terms of overall spending. Of that money, we are expecting to see an increase over time as the number of individuals that may be eligible increases. But in terms of the SNAP changes, proposals have been made to change the work requirements for able-bodied adults without dependents. So adults who are able to work do not have children under the age of six. If they aren't working at least 20 hours a week, they're proposing work requirements for all states. There's also been proposals to increase the burden placed on state governments to fund the food stamp program for eligible participants. And so there's been some years and some target goals for how much costs should be placed on the states for the program. And then there's also been the proposal to create a harvest box, which essentially is more shelf-stable foods, and recipients would essentially get this box of goods that would be selected and presented to them, and then they would have some additional benefits to spend on an EBT card.
Now, most of the things you just talked about, there is some controversy over them. And let's talk about work requirements a little bit. This is something that Wisconsin's legislature had passed and requested a waiver from the federal government. And that's how it had worked in the past, right? If a state wanted to add work requirements for SNAP recipients, the federal government had to sign off on it. With this change now, it would say states go for it. Do I have that right?
States would have more flexibility, according to some, to actually implement the program the way they see fit. But the goal is to ensure that if you're going to be receiving SNAP benefits and you are able to work, you are at least dedicating, I think they set the amount of hours per week to right at around 20. So that could be 20 volunteer hours, 20 hours in a workforce development program, or 20 hours just working part-time. It's really, I guess, some critics' way of arguing that if you're going to be receiving any type of benefits, then you should be at least contributing to society in some capacity. And so states could seek those waivers to permit people who are able-bodied adults without dependents to not work those 20 hours, but it's part of a larger push associated with welfare programs in general to try to get more individuals working or eventually towards those part-time and full-time jobs.
Do we know what kind of impact that would actually have in terms of potentially driving people off of food assistance for good reasons that would be considered successful, they're going to work, or for reasons people might consider bad reasons, they can't find work, they can't meet the requirements?
So the SNAP program doesn't work like some other programs. So if you're thinking about like the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family program, so TANF, those have certain thresholds that once you make $1 more over that threshold, you are no longer eligible for the program. So food stamps, it's really a little bit more leeway in terms of how much you can earn. And most of the recipients of SNAP benefits are actually children. So there have been some studies, particularly by economists, that have pointed out that children are more often to be those receiving the benefits of SNAP. So those calls of abuse are actually few and far between when you look at the actual research.
Samantha Mosier is with us from Missouri State University, looking at some of the latest news on the Farm Bill and talking about what the Farm Bill does. It's about a lot more, as she says, than farming. What are some of the biggest sticking points as this goes through Congress beyond the changes to SNAP?
And so if you're looking at Congress in terms of the overall debate, the Farm Bill has actually been a very difficult piece of legislation to get through Congress. There have been a number of changes in terms of your overall ideological makeup. So you have what some would say a polarization or even a hyperpolarization of members of Congress. And the Farm Bill represents this very long-seated compromise between urban districts, which are typically more liberal, more Democrat, as opposed to more rural districts, which are typically more conservative and more Republican. And so you've had this constant balance between these two groups for the past half a century to try to get the bill adopted. And if ideologically it's becoming more polarized, it's a little bit more difficult to get compromise between both parties and among those different ideological values. And then when you add on the differences and some of the fractures, and particularly in the Republican Party, with some of these Freedom Caucus members and some of the Tea Party Republicans really wanting to cut back spending, this may actually cause quite a bit of problems, particularly in a midterm election year where Republicans are coming under fire in certain districts.
Can you talk some about the impact on rural areas? You mentioned crop insurance programs are part of this, commodity programs, pricing, agricultural commodity pricing. I mean, we could talk probably for hours and hours about each of those things, but can you talk about the impact of all of this on rural America and maybe some of the sticking points?
So in terms of the overall changes associated with the agricultural part, there's been quite a bit of discussion about crop insurance programs and some of the changes that are coming out there. There has been an increased burden, particularly to ask farmers associated with the crop insurance premiums. They pay a little bit more as opposed to the taxpayers, so this could be costing farmers a little bit more than it did last time around. There's going to be some potential changes associated with the sugar program. And generally, it looks mostly the same, but there will be some of those measures that may want to tinker with it to try to drive down overall costs and really try to reduce the amount of money we spend on the bill as a whole. So it could impact rural America. There are also some of those economic considerations dealing way outside of this particular bill. So when we talk about imposing trade tariffs, those may be hitting rural America and farmers a little bit harder and the more immediate short term rather than anything that's going on with the Farm Bill.
You talked about the politics a little bit earlier. Is there a sense that this thing is just around the corner? We're going to have a Farm Bill in hand pretty soon, or is this going to be a long knockdown, drag out fight?
I don't know. The last time around, it turned into a pretty good knockdown, drag out fight. Actually, the past two times, it's been a pretty good debate and pretty intense debate between both parties. And it's supposed to happen every 5 years, but I would not personally be surprised if it took until after the midterm elections to get adopted.
We'll leave it there. Samantha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks.
That was Samantha Mosier, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Missouri State University. She was with us to talk about potential changes to the Farm Bill as Congress takes up the measure today. Now, people flying out of Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee may soon be able to help deal with homelessness when going through security. A new idea would place containers at checkpoints where people could place that spare change they empty out of their pockets. The money would go toward rental assistance and employment support for homeless people in Milwaukee County. James Matthey is the Milwaukee County Housing Administrator. He's here to tell us more about the plan. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So if and when this goes into effect, if I'm flying out of Milwaukee, what am I going to see?
Sure. So we are designing our meters right now. So they will be about 6 feet tall or so. That'll be at all the security lines. And it'll be some education language on there about our plan to end chronic homelessness, as well as containers for individuals to donate their change.
And where did this idea come from?
So I was actually on vacation flying through Denver's airport when I first noticed this last year, and thought it was just a really innovative idea as a way to kind of further a public-private partnership around homelessness. So I brought that idea here, worked it through the county board and the county executive's office, and got full support for this. So we're looking at being able to place these at all the security checkpoints this summer.
And is this working pretty well in Denver? From what you know, people are willing to lighten the load as they get on the plane?
Yes, that was the amazing thing about the research. So when I got back home and looked at the finances, they were able to raise over $280,000 in 3 years, which kind of blew my mind when I looked at it. So we certainly aren't going to get the kind of traffic necessarily that they do in Denver, but I think this will be a great way to have some permanent private money to put towards homelessness.
And so that money comes in one nickel at a time. Then what are you going to do with it? What exactly happens to help deal with homelessness?
Sure. So I think the innovative thing about this that we came up with is 100% of those funds will go to the Greater Milwaukee Foundation in our Housing First endowment that we set up with them. So again, this is another public-private partnership where 100% of these funds go directly to rental assistance, case management, and employment services. And for your listeners, I think the important part of this is 100% of this goes to our clients and their services. There's no administrative money from Milwaukee County or any of our service partners with us, so folks can be insured that 100% of the funds go to actual services.
Talking to James Matthey, Milwaukee County Housing Administrator, about a new program that will be collecting spare change from people who want to donate it as they go through the security line in the airport in Milwaukee. James, can you give us a sense of the scope of homelessness in Milwaukee County these days?
Sure. We've made a lot of progress in Milwaukee County. We announced our plan to end chronic homelessness September of 2015 with the goal of ending chronic homelessness within 3 years. I'm happy to report that we are approaching that goal, and we hope to be the largest county in the nation to accomplish that later this fall. The important thing, though, is not to just say congratulations on any of that. It's really about where do we move our homeless system in the future. So we know using the Housing First philosophy that providing permanent housing with that Housing First philosophy is the solution for homelessness. So really what we want to do with private funds once we end chronic homelessness is really focus on individuals that are at risk of homelessness, going through our eviction system, different things like that, to really keep the homeless numbers trending in the right direction. Milwaukee County's seen about a 40% reduction in overall homelessness since our community adopted Housing First in 2015. So we really just want to keep moving that needle forward going into 2019.
You kind of breezed through that there, ending chronic homelessness as a near-term goal. That sounds huge.
It is. It is. We're very excited about it. And really, it's taken so many different community partners, Milwaukee County, the City of Milwaukee, the business community, the Milwaukee Police Department, District Attorney's Office. Our whole community has really adopted this Housing First model and really looked at homelessness differently. And I think we'll be able to be a leader around the country using this model.
Give us a sense of, you know, I know everybody's story is going to be different, but take what we may think of as a typical person in Milwaukee County dealing with chronic homelessness. Walk us through what they've gone through in this Housing First plan.
Sure. So really what Housing First means is that we view housing as a solution to homelessness. So when our community was doing homeless outreach over the years, a lot of times we would ask individuals if they were engaged in their mental health treatment or if they were engaged in their alcohol and drug treatment or if they're taking medications, those are different types of things. The Housing First model, the big change is we're able to take individuals who have been living on the street sometimes for over 10 years and put them immediately into permanent housing and then wrap voluntary services around them after the fact, and that's really made a big difference. So individuals are getting their basic needs met and then are able to focus on treatment, they're able to focus on employment and those other things. But it's really important that we provide that permanent housing access to individuals off the street as quickly as possible.
And are you finding that as people, after being homeless, maybe for years, once they have that housing in place, that security of the housing, is it easier for them then to deal with, the mental illness problem or the addiction problem or whatever might be going on in their lives?
It is. That's the win-win, as we talk about it, with Housing First. So the quality of life for the clients we serve obviously is through the roof, but we're saving an incredible amount of money through the data that we track with Medicaid savings, reductions in jail days. We're saving a considerable amount of Medicaid funds for people not going to emergency rooms anymore, not going back to our behavioral health division. So it's one of those rare instances with public policy where the quality of the lives of the folks we're serving is dramatically better, but the cost savings is really immense.
Yeah, thinking about somebody living without a home, being homeless, thinking about all the time and energy that would go into solving so many of the problems that are solved if you have a home. Where do you put your stuff? Where do you find a bathroom? Where do you clean up? Like, having all that off the plate is going to make it easier to deal with other problems in someone's life.
Absolutely. Some of what our data has showed is 100% of the individuals that are in our Housing First program accept voluntary case management and voluntary services. So that we were a little surprised about, but again, when the folks we serve feel that their basic needs are being met, and they're seeing that they can trust the system a little bit, they're willing to accept those services, they're willing to do job training and those different types of things. So it's been really successful. The other thing that we've seen is the 97% success rate keeping these individuals housed. And again, it's pretty remarkable using this Housing First philosophy, working with people off the streets that have never been successfully housed before, to have that level of success in our community really says something about the model.
And stepping back into the airport for a moment, when will these security line change donation meters be popping up?
So we're working on our prototype right now. Our goal, it might be a little aggressive, we'll see how we do, maybe for the 4th of July holiday.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's James Mathey, administrator of the Milwaukee County Housing Division. He was with us to talk about a new plan that could let passengers at Mitchell Airport donate their spare change to benefit the area's homeless population, help provide housing there, and talked about plans to end chronic homelessness in the near term in Milwaukee County. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of a new biography of the late comedian and actor Robin Williams. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, here's a common story around the country. Millennials, they hit the big time after graduating from college. They go to huge cities like New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, or those hip high-tech places like San Francisco or Seattle. But according to our next guest, more and more of them are opting for mid-sized cities, places like Colorado Springs, Louisville, and Madison. Patrick Sisson is a senior reporter for Curbed, where he writes about how urbanism, cities, transportation, and architecture shape culture and urban life. His recent piece was titled "The New Magnetism of Mid-Sized Cities." Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I know the data you write, there's not a ton of data and research on this, but anecdotally at least, you're seeing a lot of this going on. What kind of decisions are millennials making as they weigh, you know, the fancy big city versus maybe that mid-sized city they grew up in?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it boils down to, as anyone in a mid-sized city would be able to tell you, it really boils down to quality of life, right? Homes are affordable, there's good jobs, you have a chance to have a lot more community engagement, and you also have a much shorter commute. A lot of millennials are finding that they're making that trade-off a lot earlier in life and deciding, hey, like, this is not just a chance to go home. This is a chance to advance in my career and do things I love.
But this the big city after college especially trend, that's been there, and that's been there for quite a while now. Isn't that right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a lot of movement, especially as the economy moves toward tech sector jobs, service jobs, to really be in a place where there's, a lot of quote-unquote innovation happening. A lot of people are there together, you know, creating new businesses, doing new jobs. So there's always going to be that attraction. I think what you're finding is that people may have assumed that that was sort of the only trend going on and not sort of seeing the fact there's a lot of interesting, engaging things happening in these mid-sized cities like your Madison, like your Milwaukee, like your Louisville.
Let's look at a couple of the cities you focus on in the piece you wrote about this. Louisville, Kentucky, I think most of us here in Wisconsin don't know a ton about that, wouldn't think of it as like a magnet for people to move. What's going on there?
Well, you're seeing, something that is happening in cities across the country. My story really looked at a couple, Sarah and Ravi Bhatia. They were living in Chicago, and Sarah was originally from Louisville, and they decided, let's look at moving. And I think the calculus that they made and the calculus that a lot more people are making these days is that, you know, they both worked in Chicago. They could afford apartments, move back to Louisville. Sarah could study for the GMATs. Ravi could have a job at a new advertising agency, and they can afford a house on one salary. It's something that really would have been quite a sort of far-fetched dream in Chicago. They also found out that, you know, as Sarah put it, Louisville's getting cool. You know, there's a lot more restaurants and bars and stuff happening downtown. It's something that a lot of people are calling, you know, a little bit more of like sort of small city urbanism, right? Like places are building river walks, they're building town squares, they're focusing on bicycling paths, all these things to really create sort of a vibrant city life in these smaller towns. They really love it. They feel like they're not, you know, the knock people would say is like you're going to make a trade-off, right? You're moving to a smaller city. They didn't find that at all. They found that it really helped their careers. It helped their housing, and they're going to start a family soon. So these things all sort of add up for them. And again, it's anecdotal, but it's something you see in a lot of other places. And you're also seeing a lot more companies invest in talent, in entrepreneurship in these smaller cities as well.
Do you see this as something that is happening, just this is sort of a natural economic development, or are some of these small and mid-sized cities, you know, trying to make it happen? Are they making conscious decisions to boost that quality of life, to lure these kind of people there?
Yeah, I think it's both, definitely both. A good example would be a place like Pittsburgh, right? Pittsburgh, you know, was this huge manufacturing hub, a steel city. When those industries really suffered and declined in the 80s, it really hurt Pittsburgh quite a bit. Now, Pittsburgh has been one of the most successful sort of comeback stories because they've invested a lot in local talent, education, and sort of making the city more attractive, right? You have Carnegie Mellon, is this huge, big you know, centerpiece university. A lot of tech has come out of that. A lot of people have invested in that technology scene. You've seen the city invest a ton in, like, parks, green space, things like that. That's all sort of creating an environment where people want to come back, businesses want to relocate there. It's really been a huge success story. I think a lot of other cities are doing similar things. You're seeing public-private partnerships, flagship universities, all invest in, you know, really building up the sort of new economic base of these places.
And I want to get into one of the things that might be pushing people out of the cities that people have been moving toward. I saw you mentioned housing costs earlier. I think I just saw a number this week. If you realistically want to own a home in, say, San Francisco, you probably want an income at least $330,000 a year. The housing costs in some of these attractive places right now, they're just becoming unattainable for a lot of people, even with decent jobs.
Yeah. No, and you know, it's the kind of thing where it's an increasing weight on some of these cities that might eventually be a big problem, if it's not already a problem. I mean, yeah, you're seeing, because a lot of these cities are not building housing at the rate they should based on the amount of economic growth, that, yeah, housing costs are going through the roof. San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, those are all great examples of, you know, a shortage of housing is creating an affordability crisis, which really is pricing a lot of people out. It's making the move make a lot more sense for people.
Talking to Patrick Sisson, a senior reporter for Curbed. He wrote an article, The New Magnetism of Mid-Sized Cities, talking about people, millennials in particular, maybe not staying in those big cities that have been drawing them, moving to small to mid-sized cities, maybe the ones they grew up in, maybe not. You can join in if this is your story, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Patrick, you did you mentioned Madison earlier as one of the cities you're looking at in this trend. What's the view from outside of Wisconsin of Madison as a place to move to?
Well, one of the things that came up, and we actually did a story about Madison a little earlier in the year. You know, Madison has been recognized as a city with a tech scene that has a lot of potential. The Brookings Institution recently released a report earlier this year. Madison was one of the top 10 cities for tech growth. You know, you see, like, Epic is obviously a huge employer there. People see a lot of potential in Madison, and a lot of that is because of the assets that are there. Obviously, you know, you have the lakes. It's a great place to live. In addition to that, you have the UW system. You know, Wisconsin has, I think, something like 60% of college graduates in Wisconsin were born in Wisconsin. That's the eighth highest rate in the nation. Like, Wisconsin does a good job of attracting talent, and a lot more people are starting to see that.
Is there a risk that these mid-sized cities could be victims of their own success? Places like Madison are seeing housing costs shoot up pretty quickly, mm-hmm. You know, not on a par with, you know, neighborhoods in Brooklyn or San Francisco or Seattle or Portland, but going up, is there a risk that they're going to end up having that same sort of factor pushing people out again?
Yeah, and you know, yeah, exactly. Madison, I think maybe a month or two ago, there was a report that said the housing values went up about 7.8% in the last year. And, you know, it is an issue where, you know, growth brings a lot of challenges. I can't say that there's, you know, anyone's really had figured out a great solution. But, yeah, I mean, it's something that a lot of cities are struggling with, how to balance, you know, increased growth, increased jobs, increased wealth with, you know, keeping things affordable.
Is there a formula for a small to mid-sized city who isn't in this game yet, isn't in that attractive category yet, doesn't have that percentage of millennials moving in, to try to get a piece of this?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good question. I would actually sort of I'm going to answer that by bringing up another writer. There's a writer called James Fallows and his wife Deborah Fallows, both authors, both journalists. They just released a book called Our Towns, and they spent 5 years going to all these, you know, these types of mid-sized cities across the country. And what they really found was that even if you don't have the advantages of, say, you know, a huge flagship university or, you know, an advanced manufacturing core, or a lot of these things that people point to as sort of what gives you a head start, there's still a lot of sort of community building and things you can do. They point to, again, this focus on sort of small-scale urbanism, focused on redeveloping sort of main streets and downtowns. You know, a lot of these smaller cities have, you know, incredible, like, downtown districts that can be sort of revitalized and redeveloped. They chronicle going to a lot more cities than I have in the last 5 years, and they said they really saw this new sense of dynamism in these towns. And it doesn't necessarily come from towns that you would think have this huge advantage. So it's definitely possible, and a lot of places are doing it. They also mentioned public-private partnerships is a huge sort of driver in what's going on. You see the private sector and the public sector get together, figure out how to, you know, develop some of these projects, create special economic districts. These are the things that are sort of driving this growth.
And thanks in part to your review, Patrick. We're going to get a line out to the Fallows to get them on to talk about this book. But are they making kind of a splash with this in the sort of urban planning community?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a book that's been really well received, and I think it does. You know, again, like I said with my story, you know, I'm certainly working in part from sort of anecdotal sort of observations and interviewing a lot of people, and also, you know, stats about, you know, job growth and people moving back. So while there's a lot of facts there, you also have to be on the ground, and they've been on the ground a lot more than a lot of other people.
Patrick Sisson is with us, senior reporter for Curbed. We're talking about the growing appeal of small and mid-sized cities for millennials, as opposed to the larger cities a lot of them went to after graduating maybe from college. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your story or the story of your community. If you're a millennial, where did you go after graduating from high school, trade program, college? Did you head for big city life like Chicago? Have you thought about, have you moved back to a place closer to where you grew up? Where do you call home today? And in your community, whatever size it is, do you see a problem with younger people moving out and not coming back? Or are you starting to see them return? What is it that will help bring people back? What do you want to change to make your community more hospitable, maybe to the younger generation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about the growing appeal of small and mid-sized cities for millennials. Patrick Sisson is with us, senior reporter for Curbed. We're talking about his recent piece, The New Magnetism of Mid-Sized Cities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're the millennial or the parent of millennials, what are you seeing? What kind of factors are there in deciding if you go to a bigger city, a mid-sized city, maybe your own hometown? Would you want to stay in your hometown, but maybe there aren't the jobs there or other amenities? What would it take to get you to stay there or move back, maybe after college or part of a career? What's going on in your community? Are you seeing some of the things our guest is talking about? Quality of life improvements of one sort or another. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, Patrick, looking at those big cities, you know, maybe they're not as appealing toward millennials. They're not exactly ghost towns now, are they? They're not emptying out.
Right, right. I mean, I think that the fact that maybe a trend of people moving to or staying in smaller and mid-sized cities doesn't mean people aren't going to still head to the bigger cities. That's not. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. That's just the nature of sort of people looking for opportunity and jobs. I just think what we're seeing is there's a realization that there's a lot of opportunity and jobs in other places as well.
I want to check out one of the other cities you got some stories from, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Tell us what you're seeing there.
That has been another example where there's a really growing tech scene. You're seeing a huge influx of millennials move there. It's also, again, like a more affordable option. Colorado is, great sort of environment, great place to live. All these things are kind of combining. And it's something you're seeing across a lot of other cities in the West. Salt Lake City is also, seeing a big boom in sort of similar industries and for similar reasons.
And we see here in Wisconsin, Governor Walker and the legislature signed a $6 million bill, $6-plus million bill to ramp up efforts to attract workers from nearby states aimed at Chicago, Twin Cities, I think Detroit's on there as well. And is this something that state city governments can do, just go out and kind of try to loot residents of other places?
Looting might be a strong word, but it's actually something that you're seeing a lot of cities and economic development groups and states really focus on. I actually had spoken to some of the people involved in this effort for a different article. It's something that's, reinforcing a lot of the points we already made in this conversation, talking about the sort of value you can have in value living in a place like, Madison, Wisconsin, as opposed to Chicago. It's economic development money that is attracting talent. There's a lot of ways to spend that money. This is something that, really is trying to market and, maybe change people's perceptions about Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Green Bay. Tim, hi.
Hello. So I would just like to say my experience, or at least my observation in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where I live, is that we are doing all the river walk and all the really nice things to, like you said, attract the talents from outside the city or to bring people back. And all that's so nice, but my observation is much of the population of people that are moving here are just escaping high cost of living from somewhere else. They're not bringing the skills or anything like that with them. They're just people from maybe the lower end of the social economic class, and they're just moving to Green Bay because it has nice stuff and still has an affordable cost of living.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Patrick, what do you think?
I think that while you definitely see that a lot, and I think that's something that can cause some consternation in some cities like Green Bay. I mean, I look at the way that, a lot of towns in the West especially feel like there's a lot of people moving from San Francisco who are sort of trading the value of a home in San Francisco for quality of life somewhere else. I think while that's happening, there's sort of different trends going on, right? There's people, looking for better quality of life, and there's also sort of this economic development happening. And ideally, you want those two things to be happening in parallel.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us now in Grafton. Laura, hi.
Hi there. I actually am recently back in Wisconsin, grew up in southeastern Wisconsin, and moved away in my early 20s, spent about 6 years in Minneapolis and the Twin Cities, and then spent another 6 years out in Denver. Moved to both of those locations for the active lifestyle, the outdoor opportunities that were available, as well as arts and food, and the way the cities offered some progressive ideas and really seemed to be moving forward and had great opportunities just for jobs, but also just for new and interesting things that were happening. Moved back to Wisconsin about 3 years ago just to be closer to family and raise our young kids, but I would say that I miss all of those things that I experienced in Minneapolis and Denver. You don't really have all of those outdoor opportunities as as obvious as they are out there, and you definitely don't have the same type of arts and food type of communities that you have in those cities either.
So, Laura, you said you moved to be closer to family. Does it feel like you're in a good place for raising kids compared to Denver or the Twin Cities, or do you think you would have done just as well back there?
I think I would have done just as well back there. We actually tried to get our family to move out with us to Denver, but that wasn't a possibility. Otherwise, we would still be there.
Laura, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And Patrick, Laura brings up actually kind of two points related to family that we haven't gotten into. People considering, am I close to my family members for one reason or another, and where do I want to raise kids? Can you talk about those factors in shaping these decisions?
Yeah, sure. Laura, thanks for calling and sharing your story. I think a lot of people find there's obviously great attraction to both of those things. You know, that's always been a big animating factor in deciding where people move, especially when they're older and start a family. A lot of the people I've spoken to have mentioned that's been a big driver. This couple I mentioned in Louisville, some people I spoke to who moved back to places like Asheville, North Carolina, out west to smaller cities in California. It's a huge animating factor and a huge part of this move back. I think people are just, from some of the stories and things I've read and heard from, some people are doing it sort of earlier in life than they would before.
Laura, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Tim with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Tim, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, my wife and I, we had lived in Madison area and La Crosse, and just kind of found that the cost of living was very high there. We moved over to central Wisconsin. We're both in healthcare, and we just kind of now, my wife wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and we can do that with the housing being about half the price and all the beautiful natural resources in the area, and kind of a perfect area to raise a family and not the hustle bustle of the city. So for us, just moving away from the city and that, for the family, has been quite a bonus. Central Wisconsin and the big cities and the prices.
And briefly, Tim, were you able to get the job you wanted in healthcare in Wisconsin Rapids area, or are you commuting?
No, I actually work right in Wisconsin Rapids for the Veterans Administration, and we have a small home care business, and then we have the Marshfield Clinic and Aspiris and all kinds of great healthcare here. So it's a great area to be in. The wages do. They do stay pretty close to the same as the bigger city areas.
Tim, great. Thanks a lot for sharing your story. Patrick, just a few moments. Do you think this trend of people going to these smaller to mid-sized cities, this is going to continue out in the next decade or so?
Yeah, I think, for a lot of different reasons. I just think that people are finding, the affordability question, there's definitely a big answer in a lot of these smaller to mid-sized cities. And I think people are finding there's a lot of excitement in, being part of sort of growing businesses there and being entrepreneurs. So, yeah, I definitely see it continuing.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Patrick Sisson. He's a senior reporter for Curbed, where he writes about how urbanism, cities, transportation, and architecture shape culture and urban life. Talked to him about a piece he wrote on the increasing number of millennials moving to America's mid-sized cities, not just streaming to the biggest and hippest cities anymore. You can still share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you made that change, that decision yourself?